ladies and gentlemen.
Good morning.
The first case this morning is Automotive Finance Corporation against the Smart Auto Center. Mr. Twinkle.
Good morning, Your Honors. This case exposes the dark side, both literally and figuratively, of the auto sales world of commerce. Any commercial act which, in order to be successful, must be carried out in the dark of the night should raise alarms in our courts. The district court erred in its handling of this case, and I would like to highlight two issues in my primary argument, and if time permits, address the other three issues that are on appeal. First of all, when repossessing collateral that has multiple units, as was done in this case, does the law recognize that a breach of the peace may occur as to some of those units, but not as to all of them? And then a related point, if so, what constitutes control sufficient to shield a creditor from the penalty of breaching the peace under the Uniform Commercial Code? The second point I'd like to get to is whether the completed negotiation of a bailment agreement constitutes evidence of a ready and willing tender sufficient to redeem property, as occurred in this case.
Before we start, Mr. Twinkle, I just have a little factual question. Where in the record will we find a writing purporting to modify the September 2nd, 1999 promissory note and security agreement?
Yes, Your Honor. The position that the appellant takes regarding that issue is not that there was a written modification, but that there is equitable estoppel as to the right of the appellee to enforce the decision, or to enforce the agreement under the facts of this case, because the appellee lured the appellant into a circumstance where, in reliance upon giving over collateral, he gained a forbearance until January 20, and the appellee, in advance of that date, repossessed the vehicles. It is not our position that there was a written modification, rather that there ought to be equitable estoppel under Indiana law as set forth in our brief.
You agree that a writing is necessary to modify the agreement?
Absolutely.
There is none here.
Absolutely.
My original question leads me to a second question, and that is this. If Mr. Schweibinger was not obliged to make any payments until January 20th, why was he attempting to make payments in December of 99 and early January of 2000?
Well, he needed to make payment by the 20th, and he was making efforts to comply with that looming obligation. Then, the court correctly found that there was a breach of the peace in this case that occurred at approximately 10 o'clock p.m. when that repossession was underway. Now, what we know is that while the court was correct that a breach of the peace occurred, the issue is, how is it that there can only be a breach of the peace as to four of the vehicles as opposed to all 20? The analogy I would suggest to the court would be this. Say a repossessor has come in to repossess a room full of furniture and has gathered, one of the people has gathered the television and is standing in the room, another has gathered a stereo unit, is out in the hallway, and another has gathered a chair, is out in the parking lot. When there then occurs a breach of peace between the debtor and the creditor, has the debtor the right to claim a breach of peace as to all? Has the creditor obtained control over one or more of the units? It is our position that because there was a breach of the peace while this was underway, while the repossession was underway, it taints all 20 vehicles, and the court
did
not
do that. Isn't it a finding of fact that we would only review for clear error that the creditor had exercised control over these 16 vehicles before the objection was made.
I agree with that. I agree that that is...
If it's a finding of fact reviewed for clear error, how can you win it?
Well, because the facts established that there was clear error here. The repossession continued until 2 o'clock in the morning, several hours after the sheriff's department had arrived. One of the repossessors showed the vehicle identification numbers, the VIN numbers of the vehicles to the sheriff's department while they were there. And the facts then demonstrate, contrary to what the district court judge found, that indeed they did not have control of all 20 vehicles. The only basis for the judge's finding in that regard is a few words from one of the repossessors that they were down to the last four. That is without explanation. It's contrary to the testimony of Mr. Schwibinger that when he arrived, all of the cars were lined up on the lot.
That's particularly clear when he arrived here either. Is it 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock?
Well, the judge found he arrived at 10 o'clock. That's the finding of fact. So if you go by the findings of fact, if Mr. Schwibinger arrived at 10 o'clock, the repossession started around 10 o'clock, all of the cars were lined up on the lot, that actually is consistent with the time of his arrival, that the cars were still there, then clearly they had not gained control. And that is a significant factual issue that the court just missed. It took a phrase out of a deposition and based in a ruling on 16 of the vehicles on that one phrase in the deposition, contrary to the substantial weight of all of the other evidence.
Mr. Tabinko, forgive me, I'm going back again.
Okay.
But somewhere in my... Didn't you claim somewhere that Trial Exhibit Q was the writing that modified the September 2nd agreement?
Well, Trial Exhibit Q is evidence of the... not of a modification, but of the agreement that the parties had reached in December. We're not claiming it was a modification of the agreement. We're claiming that that is evidence that, in fact, the parties had reached an understanding that no action would be taken until January 20th. That's an act. The debtor acts to his detriment in reliance thereupon, and therefore there is equitable estoppel as to that. The issue then as to the district court leaving what really becomes a moving target in the law for repossession companies. At what point does one gain sufficient control? I don't believe that issue has been answered adequately under Indiana law or in our Seventh Circuit. The court relies upon an Eighth Circuit case. And I believe it's an important issue for this circuit to look at what point does the repossessor have to stop, desist his activity, and proceed to court. And I believe, Your Honors, that when we get to this point where the debtor arrives on the property, a breach of the peace occurs, indeed they must desist as to all units that they are in the process of repossessing. Now, the other issue, and that is on tender, that I want to address, and the tender question goes to whether or not the debtor is ready, willing, and able to redeem. In this case, they had negotiated a bailment agreement in wherein the debtor would pay the creditor all of the money that was due, and the creditor, after the negotiation is complete, imposes on top of that, well, you also have to provide us a complete release of all claims. That is contrary then, and in fact denies the right of the debtor to effectuate the redemption. The trial court is an error here, the district court is an error here as well, in that the district court says, well, that is nothing but a new promise to pay. It is not a new promise to pay the old debt. It is a means of establishing the manner of redemption. And in that regard, the district court erred in finding that there had not been an adequate redemption. The case that we cite, the Laker case, is the appropriate statement of the law in Indiana in this regard that the court should look to, and that is that when a party gives a redemption, that you cannot frustrate that redemption effort by also imposing on it the requirement that a complete release of all claims occur. Either or both of these primary issues gets us back to the point where the case needs to be remanded back to the district court for a further finding as to damages. I will reserve the balance of my time, Your Honors, for my rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Grove.
Good morning. I'm Stephen Grove on behalf of Automotive Finance Corporation. This appeal is nothing more than a request for this court to reweigh the evidence and second-guess the factual findings of Judge McKinney. The appeal, in this case, brought by this dealer, has ignored the evidence favorable to the judgment and instead relies solely on the evidence that is in favor of the dealer's version of events. But Judge McKinney, who sat through this trial, he listened to the dealer's testimony and he weighed it against all the evidence. Judge McKinney found that the dealer's testimony was not credible, and he gave priority to the contradicting evidence. This court should not reweigh the evidence. You should reject that invitation and affirm the district court's findings. I would like to address three of the issues that have been raised on appeal and demonstrate for you the evidence that was presented at trial that supports the district court's findings and show how this is merely a request to reweigh the evidence. Before I continue, does any judge have any questions they would like me to address at the outset? The first issue that has been raised by the dealer on appeal is whether or not the dealer was in default. The basis for this argument is an intermingled argument that there was a verbal modification to the loan documents, coupled with an argument that there was an equitable estoppel on the part of AFC. As this court has recognized, as Judge Evans inquired and Mr. Tamwinkle admitted, there was no written modification to the loan documents. Judge McKinney specifically found that, and that AFC representatives testified there was none. That is really not a disputed issue. When we look at the equitable estoppel argument, we see that that really does not apply to these facts, because equitable estoppel requires a misrepresentation of fact. And in this case, if you take that argument and apply it to our facts, AFC would have had to misrepresent this alleged future deadline of January 20th. But there's no evidence that they had a plan in place to trick this dealer into this conduct and then take the deadline away from them. The evidence simply shows that there never was a modification that would allow all payments to be extended to January 20th. The best evidence that you'll find on this case is Exhibit 12. In hindsight, I probably should have put that in my appendix, but Exhibit 12 is an email from the branch manager that details exactly what transactions took place at the December 3rd, 1999 meeting. It's almost contemporaneous, within a couple of days of that meeting, and it's an internal record keeping, so it's got a high level of credibility, and it shows how AFC simply extended additional credit to the dealer. That credit was applied to make his account current. It paid off two out-of-trust vehicles and other vehicles that were overdue. There was no modification of the deadline so that all payments would be excused until January 20th. There's an interesting comment in there that it says that this extra 30 days should give the dealer enough time to get his affairs in order and keep the account current. If you look at the timing of that, this dealer was on a 45-day account. With that, in the 30 days, at first I thought it might have been a misstatement, but really what it refers to is the oldest vehicles were 2 weeks overdue. And by giving the dealer an extra 45 days, you backdate it to the prior due date, and that would be the 30 days. Then going to the question of the number of vehicles that were in control at the time the dealer arrived, the district court's finding that they had 16 vehicles under their control when the dealer arrived is supported by the direct testimony of Eric Peterson, the president of the repossession company. He was asked the question, what time was it when the dealer arrived? And his answer was, exact time, I don't recall. Car-wise, we were down to the last four. And that's the testimony that Judge McKinney relied upon when he found that AFC had 16 vehicles under their control before the dealer arrived. I would point out that that answer was spontaneous. And he gave his deposition months before I had come up with the argument of splitting the collateral bit by bit. In other words, early on in the case, at least I was thinking of the collateral of a single unit. Because the case is discussing it, and deal with a trailer home or a boat or whatever, an individual's car. And it wasn't until after I was preparing for trial and I filed that testimony, I realized 16 of these cars should not even be considered during the breach of the peace claim. Those 16 we already had free and clear, and those should be taken out of this analysis. And that's the theory that I presented to Judge McKinney, and he agreed. There is no reason why you can't divide collateral if it's individual separate items and show that AFC had control of all of the 16. In fact, if you look at, there's one particular finding of fact that Judge McKinney made, which as I was reading through the opinion when I first got it and I was trying to get to the end, it gave me very high hopes. Finding of fact number 28 says that when the dealer arrived and made his objections known, no repossession took place. No cars were removed from the lot during that time. It was not until after the dealer had been taken away by the Sheriff's Department for disorderly conduct that AFC continued its repossession. And with our position at trial that the district court should find that there was no breach of peace whatsoever, even as to the last four vehicles, because the dealer was no longer present and was no longer able to voice an objection. I was not able to find a case which tells us how long does an objection of a dealer linger in the air and prevent the secured creditor from returning to recover their collateral. That's an interesting question, and it's not really addressed. I don't know that this case is the best one to deal with that because we don't have the precise facts about the repossession. There are some facts, like we don't know which cars were under the control, and when we don't know if they were at the staging area or if they were all the way off the lot. All we know is that AFC had control of 16 cars, and when the dealer showed up, they were down to the last four. There's one another item that I wanted to address, and that is the dealer's claim for lost profits. You will find that the dealer, as part of this appeal, brings a claim on the basis that the trial court did not award him certain damages, and these damages are lost profits from the sale of his dealership. The basic chronology is, in November, he negotiated a purchase agreement for his dealership. In December, he did the swap-out deal with AFC to try and stay current. In January was the repossession, and then in the months following, he was trying to close the sale on his dealership. He tried to persuade the trial court that this repossession that took place in January had prevented him from stocking his lot to the fullest and selling that inventory along with his dealership, because his purchase agreement with the purchaser, Mr. Mike Wolf of Wolf Chrysler Plymouth, the language in that agreement does allow him to sell his inventory, but it's at average auction value, average wholesale value. The dealer never did explain how he expected to make a profit from buying cars at auction and then selling them at auction value. But the bigger problem with this particular claim is that the dealer's credibility prevented him from making a causal connection between AFC's actions and his inability to stock his lot. He attempted to say that AFC, after the repossession, had called the auto auctions, specifically Mannheim Auto Auction in Canada, and tell them, don't do business with this dealer. But the dealer's own testimony contradicted that because he admitted in his direct examination and then on cross-examination, he was able to go up to Mannheim Auto Auction and purchase $228,000 worth of vehicles. He at first tried to blame that on AFC, but then he retracted that and said, that's a separate lawsuit against the Mannheim Auto Auction. AFC had nothing to do with that. And so therefore, there goes his causal connection. And Mannheim is the exact auction he alleged that AFC had contacted to keep him from restocking his lot. The other problem that when Judge McKinney was weighing this evidence and weighing the dealer's testimony, he also had testimony from the dealer that he had made basically an identical claim for lost profits in February of 2000 against Mike Wolf, who was going to buy his dealership. I introduced an exhibit which was a letter between the two lawyers, and in that letter the dealer was basically making a claim to the purchaser of the dealership, Mike Wolf, by saying, my client has suffered, quote, enormous economic damages, close quote, as a result of the conduct of your client. And he goes on to say how the buyer, because he had contacted employees and how he had made statements in the community, had shut down the business of the dealership. That's significant because he was trying to blame his lost income on AFC at trial when, in February of 2000, he was trying to blame his lost profits and his loss of income on the purchaser of his dealership. Next, we look at the issue of this alleged redemption of the collateral. The dealer attempts to argue that this agreement that the parties had, the bailment agreement, which I believe took place on March 31st of 2000, He wants to establish that that was a redemption under the UCC, Section 506. But Section 506, in the comments specifically says, tender of fulfillment is more than just a promise to perform the same promise that you already have. And that is exactly what the dealer was promising. He had a debt to pay. His argument was, AFC, here, give me the cars, give me the possession of my collateral back, give me the titles, I'll put those back in my inventory, and you've given up all your leverage and your secured position. I'll sell those as part of my dealership sometime down the road, and then when I get the proceeds, then you can have your money. That is not what Section 506 envisions as a tender of fulfillment. Judge McKinney made specific findings that the sale of the collateral by AFC was commercially reasonable. AFC presented two witnesses who were qualified to testify on this issue. One is Denny Corbett, which is the collection manager. He testified that he had extensive experience in the liquidation of repossessed collateral in this business, and he said that the 80% recovery that AFC made from all of its cars was very reasonable, and he was very satisfied with that result. We also had an independent witness, Donna Thompson. Now, I would concede that she's not 100% independent because she is a former employee of AFC.
It's really not necessary to argue the facts to us.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, suffice it to say that the actions that AFC took in selling the cars to a dealership and in selling to some of the cars at auction were entirely within the UCC's definition of what is commercially reasonable. Finally, I'd like to address the issue of AFC's appellate attorney's fees. The district court found that the loan documents did require the dealer to pay AFC's attorney's fees that were incurred during the course of enforcing the agreement and the contract, and we would respectfully request that this case be remanded to the district court so that appellate fees can be awarded as well. The loan documents do not distinguish between attorney's fees incurred in enforcement during the trial stage or during the appellate stage, and those should be awarded as well.
Wait, I'm not. Now you've lost me. You didn't file a cross appeal, did you?
No, Your Honor.
So how could we remand this case to the district court?
That is the...
If you want the judgment modified in your favor, you have to file a cross appeal. And maybe you're just asking us to award attorney's fees.
If it is within this court's jurisdiction to award the appellate attorney's fees, then that would be our request. It was my understanding that procedurally, if the appellate fees were appropriate, then the matter should be remanded to the district court for a determination as to the amount of fees that would be reasonable.
We usually make that determination.
In that instance, let me modify my request. And then I would ask this court if I could have permission to file an affidavit of attorney's fees after the arguments have been closed.
If there is any need, we will let you know when the time comes.
Yes, Your Honor. In closing, this court should not reweigh the evidence. You should affirm the findings of Judge McKinney in all respects. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Groves. Anything further, Mr. DeWinkle?
Yes.
The issue raised by Appelli's argument really points out squarely what this panel has the opportunity to establish for the Seventh Circuit. That is, what in the Seventh Circuit and under Indiana law constitutes control for purpose.
We can't establish anything for the Seventh Circuit. We're ventriloquist dummies. And as many lawyers say that phrase, they say it with the emphasis on the word dummy.
I'm not included. But
Frankfurter's line, I believe.
Judge, the point is that the facts, when you're looking at the facts of this case, the facts do not support the finding as made by the district court, as I've already argued to you, and I would suggest respectfully that an outlining of how the facts do line up contrary is an opportunity for the court to discuss the concept of control under the Uniform Commercial Code, which is a very important concept in the world of repossession. Then, as to the issue of tender, again, here the facts establish that the tender occurred. What we apparently have is an application of the law to the facts, which still has the plain error standard in play. But in applying the law of the Uniform Commercial Code regarding what constitutes tender of fulfillment, I believe here that the facts establish that there was an attempt to impose this additional release on top of it, and that denies and in effect operates as a waiver of the rights of the AFC in that regard. And I thank you for your time and attention to this matter.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.